rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Harris, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Louise Dovry Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, January 16th, 2025, and we have four matters on the calendar for argument this morning. The first is State of Minnesota versus Mark Anthony Berciaga. All right. So far, so good. You're both familiar with our procedures. I will just remind you, you will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. The podium is in its lowered state, but if you want to raise it for your comfort, there's a button under the middle and front, and you can do that. All right, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Joseph McInnes. I represent the appellant, Mark Berciaga. In my arguments this morning, I'd like to focus on the first two issues in my brief, which deal with the burglary conviction. And that...
You mean the sufficiency of the evidence?
There's a sufficiency claim, and then there's a jury instruction claim that I think are related to that burglary conviction. There was insufficient evidence of burglary in this case because Mr. Berciaga lived in the apartment. He lived there. He had a possessory interest in the apartment. And because of that, he was a lawful possessor who could consent to himself being there.
It's a fact issue, isn't it, whether he was in lawful possession of the apartment at the time that he broke the door, reentered it, and entered and assaulted the victim?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's a fact issue. And you would agree that the jury heard evidence that he, in fact, lived there and would have been in lawful possession. And the jury also heard evidence from T.O. that she was the one who made decisions, and she told him repeatedly to leave, and, in fact, threw him out and locked the door. So isn't there dispute there that the jury could go one way or the other as to legal possession by your client?
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think part of the problem has to do with issue two, which is that the jury wasn't properly instructed. So the jury was never given, you know, the tools to actually decide the case. They weren't told that more than one person could be in possession. They were told that it's only one person, and they essentially made that decision based on that sort of insufficient law, a misstatement of the law. And so I don't think we can necessarily put a tremendous amount of weight into the fact that, okay, they came back guilty, given that.
So your sufficiency argument is premised on that it was error to not instruct the jury that more than one person could be a lawful possessor. Is that fair?
Yes, that is fair, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
So if we disagree on the jury instruction, then we don't need to address the sufficiency argument?
No. I think they are separate arguments, and I think that I think the closest overlap between the two arguments would be in terms of if the jury instruction impacted or affected Mr. Berciaga's substantial rights. And so if we're looking at that, we've got, you know, the question of, was there sufficient evidence that the jury could reasonably conclude that Mr. Berciaga was not in lawful possession? That would be, on the one hand, the sufficiency argument, but that's different from, you know, did that affect his substantial rights in the jury's consideration? And so I think the substantial rights issue it's a broader question.
Getting back to the instruction itself, as I understand it, this is the language that you assert should have been included in the instruction. And I'm quoting from the pattern instruction. When several persons are in lawful possession of a building or of the same part of a building, any one of these persons may consent to the entry or remaining of another person.
Correct.
Help me understand how that language fits the facts of this case?
Well, I think that language fits the facts because we have, this is a situation where two people are in lawful possession and two people can consent to their entry into the apartment.
But counsel, isn't it true that that again is a fact question as to whether or not two people are in lawful possession? And under this fact scenario, not only did the district court but also defense counsel agree that the facts did not demonstrate such that two people were in lawful possession and such didn't give the Coxon instruction?
I'm not sure that that is borne out in the record. I think that...
But defense counsel, my understanding of the record, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that initially the court was going to give the instruction.
Correct.
And then the court reversed course and said, the facts, as the court sees it, does not support the giving of the instruction. And defense counsel, and then the court looked to defense counsel to see whether or not they had any response. And my understanding is defense counsel agreed not to give the instruction, or that the facts did not support the instruction. Again, all of fact determination here. And again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that the process that occurred at trial?
Yes, to an extent. What happened was that the defense counsel is giving this, stating that his defense is going to be, hey, more than one person is in lawful possession. They agree on the jury instructions. They come then at a later point. The judge says, this whole bracketed section, let's get rid of it. And that includes kind of all the other kind of permutations in the bracketed pattern instruction.
And just so I'm clear, when they came back to have the second discussion, that was after they heard the facts of the trial, they heard the testimony, and then the court said, this doesn't fit.
The court is saying these bracketed portions to the instruction don't fit, but he's not specifically stating, there's not a specific argument about lawful possession at all. The court just says, we've got all this, the court says, I'm confused by the instruction. All these bracketed sections are confusing, which deal with all sorts of different situations, including Spence and Croxon and other cases. And he says, let's just cut these out and just go straight with this, the kind of the bare minimum, and then defense counsel agrees to that.
As argued by both parties, there was nothing that prevented the jury from finding that both your client and T.O. were in lawful possession, was there?
I think what prevented them from finding that is that they didn't have the, they weren't properly instructed on it.
No, but what I'm saying is nobody argued that the, as instructed, a jury could only find one of them. I think wasn't the argument that in fact T.O. was the person who was on the lease and testified that she had the authority to make that decision and that she had told him he was no longer welcome and no longer had permission to be there.
Well, the facts were that that T.O. and Mr. Barciaga had lived together in the past in that apartment.
And she testified to that.
Correct. And this is all her testimony. She testified that he lived there, he was there on a daily basis, he was regularly there. And she also testified that all his possessions were there. She testified that his car was there. The neighbor testified that that his car was always there. And she also testified that she wanted him to remain there because she was having this CPS visit coming up.
Until she didn't want him there.
Exactly.
But so why didn't that evidence and the instruction together permit the jury to reach the conclusion that your client had a right to be there and there was not a burglary? What was it? They had the evidence in front of them.
But they, Your Honor, they had the evidence, but they didn't have the law. So they didn't have, because...
But the instruction didn't say only one person can be in lawful possession, did it?
I think that was the only kind of conclusion you could draw from the instruction, because it didn't mention multiple lawful possessors. And then I think the issue in terms of the definition of a tenant under the landlord-tenant statute, Mr. Barciaga's possession of the apartment by living in it alone, an indefinite possession of the property, created a tenancy that could only be extinguished through through.
And what evidence was there of a landlord-tenant relationship between your client and T.O.?
Well, the only evidence of that would be T.O.'s testimony of him living there on an indefinite basis and sharing
but
the apartment.
But there's no testimony that he paid rent to her, that she was a landlord in
no,
any
and,
sense.
And in fact, that was the state strategy in the case, was to not elicit information surrounding that. And one point is that...
Except I think there was testimony that T.O.'s daughter was on the lease or something like that.
There was testimony at the time of trial. T.O. testified that she and her daughter were on the lease. But when the prosecutor tried to elicit information about the lease at the time, there was a hearsay objection because the lease had never it had never been provided to defense counsel. So the court, you know, basically said to the prosecutor, you know, you can't ask about that. And so the prosecutor then asked, did you have the right to exclude people at the time? And she said yes. But that doesn't kind of resolve the issue. You know, the issue is that her testimony showed that he was living there, and his living there requires her, under the landlord-tenant statute, to provide a written notice of eviction under Lilienthal.
So, counsel, if we accept your arguments, wouldn't our opinion then, being consistent with our non-presidential, understanding it's non-presidential, decision in State versus Mitchell?
I think that's a really important question. I think Hoverston, there's enough facts and analysis in Hoverston that it's clearly distinguishable from our case. I think Mitchell is as well, because one of the things that Spence talks about is that there's two ways that a possessory interest under property law can be divested. So that would be either abandonment or the issuance of an OFP or Danko. And I should say that no OFP or Danko was in effect at this time. No court order was barring Mr. Barciaga from living there. So in Mitchell, the facts of Mitchell are that he was living, and it's kind of a, it's, you know, it's a sub-argument, and it's, or it's a, one of the last arguments, I guess, and it's very briefly states that Mitchell was there on and off, and so I think you do have to... Well,
but I think it also said he had keys, which isn't clearly demonstrated here. I mean, there are parts of the facts, as I read them, that thought, well, he had probably a stronger argument of lawful possession.
Well, I don't think it would be stronger, because I think there's far more facts here that Mr. Barciaga was using the amenities of the apartment. That, you know, the analysis, the totality of the facts analysis under Quinn, he's using all the amenities of the apartment. He's free to come and go as he pleases. He's there and regularly, which is the exact term that's used under the landlord-tenant statute, is that, you know, other regular resident of the apartment has that same protection, that they can't just be, you know, kind of instantly made homeless, you know, when it's their home under, you know, they have that extra protection.
This isn't a landlord. I'm confused by the reliance on landlord-tenant law when the case wasn't tried on that basis.
No, but Spence and Lilienthal tell us, when we're interpreting lawful possession, Lilienthal was, you know, interpreting, you know, place of abode, and does, you know, when we're interpreting when a person has a right to be in a place.
But wasn't there a lease in Lilienthal? I thought there was a lease there, which we don't have here.
I think there was an oral lease, if I'm reading.
But he was a tenant. The person there, the appellant, was a tenant on the lease.
Correct, and there was an oral lease. So, but that creates a tenancy as well. You know, an informal lease creates a tenancy. Possession of property alone under, and Spence quotes this from this law that, you know, if possession of property alone creates a tenancy at will. And a tenancy at will under our law has to be, can only be ended in writing. And I think that's because of the issues at stake where...
Counsel, that seems to me to be inconsistent with housing law, to say that possession of apartment alone creates a tenancy. Under that theory, then, I can just an individual can just go into an apartment, take possession for a day.
And I'm sorry, and you're making a critical point that's absolutely correct. Possession of a property with the consent of the owner, with the owner's consent, creates a tenancy evil. That's absolutely correct. That's a huge point. Yes, you need that consent.
With your remaining minute, and I know you've chosen not to focus on your judicial bias argument, but I, and maybe you can come back to this in your rebuttal argument. I'm really having trouble with understanding the basis for the judicial bias argument, given the fact that defense counsel asked the district court to appoint a lawyer for this witness who didn't want to testify and was trying to get out of it, that led to the mistrial. And alternatively, asked the court to advise that witness of their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, what it was the district court did wrong when it, in fact, did exactly what defense counsel asked it to do. I'm troubled by that.
Okay, so I think, so I, first of all, I'd like to say that I misstate the standard in my brief, and I believe the standard is actually not plain error, but it's de novo review under REEK, so under State v. REEK, which the state cited in their brief. And I see that I am out of time.
You can come back to that.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
Morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning for Respondent, the State of Minnesota. This Court should affirm the burglary conviction because Mr. Burciaga was not a lawful possessor of the apartment unit. This morning, I plan to come at that question from two different directions. First, at a doctrinal level, appellant was not a lawful possessor of under precedential case law. And second, because this is a sufficiency case, I want to emphasize the actual facts that were in front of the jury. So from the doctrinal perspective, there are two relevant cases, Spence and Croxon, and appellant did not satisfy the definition of lawful possessor under either of those two cases. So starting with Spence, there are actually two holdings in Spence, if you read the case closely. The first is the court provides a plain language definition of what it means to be a lawful possessor. And the court says did not rely on this notion of possessory interest generally. The court said that a lawful possessor under the burglary statute is somebody who has the right to exercise control over the premises.
And so in this case, did Mr. Burciaga have that control prior to the time that T.O. told him to leave, asked him to leave, kicked him out, and locked the door?
There's no evidence in the trial record that he was. The only evidence in the trial record was that she was allowing him to stay there, keep his belongings there. But there's no evidence of what we would ordinarily think of indicia of control, that he could actually make decisions about this property and who could be there, who could come and go. Could he allow his friends there to come and go without her permission? We don't know. All we have is her status as a lawful possessor. But in Spence, and I think this is maybe my rebuttal to some of appellant's arguments, after that first holding about what is the plain language definition of lawful possessor, the court basically said, well, the defendant in that case, he looks like a lawful possessor. He owned the house. And so they went on to a secondary analysis to determine whether somebody who was a lawful possessor could divest themselves of that control under property law. So the important point I want to make about that is the property law question didn't come in until that secondary analysis. It was only once the defendant was shown to be somebody who fell within the definition of a lawful possessor. And in fact, if you look at footnote 4 of the decision in Spence, the court specifically says, we're not going to look at other statutes to define the phrase lawful possessor if those statutes do not have that phrase themselves. So there was an argument saying, look at the theft statute. And the court said, no, That statute doesn't say lawful possessor, so we're not interested in it. So at that first step, are you a lawful possessor? We're only dealing with plain language, and the plain language rule is, did you have a right to exercise control? And getting to my second point about the actual evidence, and what I said to Your Honor, Judge Bjorkman, there's no evidence that appellant had any right to exercise control. So the second case then we turn to is Croxton, and Croxton expands on things a little bit, and it addresses, what about long-term guests? How do we determine whether a long-term guest is a lawful possessor of the apartment unit? And Croxton doesn't look to the housing law that appellant is relying on here. Croxton just says, the guest is counts as a lawful possessor if they have the tenant's, quote, permission to live there. That's what Croxton says about long-term guests.
So getting back to my other question, wouldn't Mr. Bertiaga, under this record, have been in lawful possession, given T.O.'s testimony that he lived there with her for the better part of a year?
Not at the time of the burglary, Your Honor. So Spence specifically refers to the language at the time of the burglary, and if we apply the Croxton rule to that, at the time of the burglary, she had repeatedly instructed him to pack his things and get out of the apartment. She had revoked his, quote, permission to live there. And in addition, she locked him out of the apartment, he kicked down the door, and then he struck her after kicking down the door. So under either precedent, Spence or Croxton, there is no way to conclude that Mr. Bertiaga, at the time of the burglary, was a lawful possessor of the premises. With respect to the jury instruction issue, I think there was a question maybe towards the beginning of appellant's argument about sort of the interaction between the two or what to do about the two. I do want to be clear, because I've had this issue arise in another case, that if the court were hypothetically to conclude that there was a prejudicial error with respect to the jury instruction, the appellate court still needs to reach the sufficiency issue. It creates a really thorny issue on remand for double jeopardy purposes if you don't. So I just want to make that clear.
And do you agree that the sufficiency sort of comes into the substantial impact on substantial rights, given that this is a plain error standard of review on the jury instruction?
I wouldn't call it the sufficiency issue. I mean, you're looking at the same facts. So part in a jury instruction analysis or an instruction omission analysis on prejudice, you certainly, under the three Watkins factors, you look at the strength of the state's case on the omitted element. Those facts do come into play.
I'm looking at the instruction given. Yeah. The defendant entered a building without the consent of the person in lawful possession. I mean, doesn't that convey the impression that only one person can be in lawful possession of a property? And that's not accurate, is it?
It may not be accurate, Your Honor, technically. Again, we're under plain error. And, appellant hasn't raised any error with respect to that portion of the instruction, the word the instead of a.
Well, I think the argument is that you should have, the instruction should have advised the jury that more than one, the multiple people in lawful possession, and doesn't the sentence I just read with using the person instead of a person, does that support the appellant's argument that this instruction was misleading?
Again, just going back to my point before, we're under plain error, and so there's no precedent saying that that should not be the instruction given. So appellant, if that was appellant's claim, it couldn't satisfy plain error. But Your Honor, I think I maybe disagree with your take on what appellant's claim is. Appellant's claim is that the instruction under Croxton was not given, not that in general the instructions failed to adequately advise the jury that there were possible two lawful possessors. It's specifically about the omission of Croxton. And on that issue, the district court raised this issue, told defense counsel, I don't really see how it's relevant, and defense counsel affirmatively said, you're right, I agree, that is not what our defense is. And I think the reason defense counsel said that is because the Croxton instruction does not address this defense at all. The Croxton instruction, at least from the model jig, says when several persons are in lawful possession, so that implies that that's a possibility, but the rule it gives the jury is any one of them may consent to the entry or remaining of other persons.
Right. That's the part of the instruction that I read during.
Right. It says nothing about a guest's ability to override the actual tenant's authority to control the premises. So our basic point is, how could the omission of an instruction, which does not address the legal defense at all, possibly be an error to omit from this case, particularly when defense counsel said, yeah, I agree, that doesn't really address our defense. So I just don't see any way how there could have been any error, any plain error, or any prejudice to appellant for the omission of the instruction. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll forego the remainder of my time and simply ask the court to affirm the conviction.
I want to ask you about the judicial bias argument. Help me understand why the district court's instruction to TO, which I think was given a couple different times, about the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, or privilege against self-incrimination, why the instruction given didn't kind of cross the line between giving an appropriate instruction and putting your thumb on the scale in support of the state, which I think is what the appellant is arguing.
Well, the defense asked for that instruction to be given, Your Honor. That was the defense's second request. It became pretty clear that the judge was not going to appoint the victim counsel. And so the defense said, at the very least, please instruct the victim about the possibility of self-incrimination. You have a right not to do that. So that's what the defense requested. But even if it was improper, like there was some sort of abuse of discretion in terms of what a trial judge is supposed to do in this situation, appellant's claim is not an abuse of discretion, a legal error. Appellant's claim is that this exhibited the judge's partiality for the state in this prosecution. It's a significantly higher showing that they need to make than just that the judge handled the situation maybe differently than the judge should have. So I just don't think you can look at this record where the judge granted Mr. Burciaga's motion for a mistrial during the first trial, where the district court judge said on the record at sentencing, I'm going to sentence you to the bottom of the box, even though that is a departure from my usual practice in these cases. I don't see how the judge under the totality of the facts, applying the objective observer test, you could conclude that this judge was biased against Mr. Burciaga. Unless there's further questions, we simply ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Mr. McInnes, you have the last word.
So just to return to the issue of the of judicial bias, I think what we're dealing with here is we have a judge who knows very intimately the witness in the case. When she comes into court, she's very friendly and says, oh, you know me, judge. You know I'm always going to be honest with you. And he has that relationship with her through drug court, which creates the more intimate knowledge. And then the judge not only advises her of her Fifth Amendment privilege, the judge tells her, hey, I'm not going to hold you in contempt, sort of cuts a deal with her to encourage her testimony.
Isn't that just explaining what honoring that Fifth Amendment right privilege means?
I think it doesn't, because the judge didn't tell her, if you have a good faith basis to assert your right, then, I'm not going to hold you in contempt. The judge just said, I'm not going to hold you, I promise not to hold you in contempt. And then when she did start invoking the right, the judge, I think, leads her very strongly into, by describing, hey, the one thing you could, the one crime you need to worry about is giving false information to the police when she's in the midst of maybe teetering back and forth on how closely she's going to testify to the police reports in the case. And then that kind of warning from the judge elicits, her damaging testimony against Mr. Burciaga.
So what's the most salient in your argument, sort of evidence of bias? Is it the fact that this judge has encountered this witness? And again, she's not a party in the case, but
correct,
this witness through the judge's experience as a judge, right, on the bench, dealing with this person as a defendant.
Well, I'm not sure it's totally from the knowledge on the bench because they know each other from Austin. And he
I think he references that they were both born in the same city. Is that sort of the intimate knowledge that the Dorsey case, for example, was talking about when it said a judge must recuse?
I think, you know, when we're looking at the standard of, you know, just de novo, would a layperson see this and see that, you know, not only does the judge know her, she's very friendly with the judge. He potentially has, you know, knows her from a small town, growing up in a small town. And then he's kind of cutting these kind of bizarre, you know, deals with her in order to encourage her testimony. And then advising, you know, stepping into this advocate role, advising, giving her legal advice, and that legal advice is pushing her to testify. I think to an outside observer, this would create that appearance of a relationship that crosses the line. And to return to the just to go back to the jury instruction issue, the what the court cut out was this entire bracketed section, which is dealing with buildings that are divided into separate units. And so there's a lot of information that's being cut out in that moment.
But wasn't it the Croxon instruction that you're really arguing about? And that is the part I read about people, when you have more than one person in lawful possession, that any one of those persons may consent to entry or remaining of another, like a third person.
Correct. And
that's the instruction you wanted.
And that is the instruction I wanted. Yes, that's correct.
Well, originally wanted, then agreed not to, but that you're arguing was error, not plain error, not to give.
It misstated the law. When we view the instructions as a whole, which is the standard, the instructions misstated the law of lawful possession.
And because it omitted that part about persons who both share possession, being able to give another third party, if you will, permission to enter a building.
Well, and I think I wouldn't necessarily limit that instruction in that way, because if you look at Spence was clearly about a case about multiple people in lawful and, you know, arguably in lawful possession. The argument was Spence was in lawful possession because of his ownership. So I think that and that he consented to himself entering that apartment or that home. So I think we have, I think the law is clear that somebody in lawful, when multiple people are in lawful possession, they can consent to themselves. And I think without that information, the jury didn't have the tools to decide the case. And I guess with my, dwindling seconds here, I'll just say that we do have protections in place to help domestic violence victims who call the police, and there are resources that are available to them, and we don't need to sort of make a person instantly homeless and cut them off from their possessions as a result of that. So thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both. We appreciate your arguments today and your briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.